Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4.
I know this much is so true. I know this much is true. I know this much is true.
Hang on. Welcome to Master Tapes, to Gary Kemp and Tony Hadley playing the title track from the 1983 Spandau Ballet album True. The international bestseller included songs such as Communication, Lifeline and Gold. Gary, Tony, welcome to Master Tapes.
Thank you very much.
Now, in this programme, as I say, we're taking you back to True, the third Spandau Ballet album. It's one that saw you emerge blinking into superstardom from those new romantic basement clubs. And it represented a change in the sound of the band as well, away from the post-punk and the funk, and into something far more sophisticated, a real blue-eyed pop soul sound. And it's an album that went on to sell millions of copies. You're number one here in the UK, and it cracked the Billboard charts in the States. But it's easy to forget, I guess, that Spandau, when you started in the early days, you were really seen as an underground band, weren't you?
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, we really were. I mean, we could have ended up like Depeche Mode. I like Depeche Mode. We were very much a synth-based band, you know, guitars and synths, four on the floor. And the second album, Diamond, I mean, the B-side was very experimental. Yeah. First side was quite funky, but True was, like you say, a complete departure.
But Gary, it was a master plan to hit the pop charts, though, wasn't it?
I think we'd both, all of us, had grown up buying pop singles. We started probably with Mark Bolan. Tony and I probably agree on all of this. You know, Roxy Music, David Bowie.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And later on, it would have been Soul Records for me, personally, and then punk. But Bowie throughout the whole of that period. Yeah, Bowie sort of guided us all from glam rock through soul and then into Berlin.
And you'd started off and you had those first two albums, Journeys to Glory. Well, I guess with those first singles as well, with Muscle Bound and Cut a Long Story Short, you were making an impact straight away. And you were here, I think, at Maida Vale, weren't you? Before even you were signed and before you made that record.
We were here several times. We recorded in several studios in the BBC.
Peter Powell was a big backer of us and liked the band. In a way, what we were doing, because punk was so anti-establishment and so anti-being commercial, we were trying to be subversive by saying, we want to be commercial. We want to sell lots of records. We'll sell them on our terms, and we'll look like this, and we'll play this kind of music.
Yeah.
But it's about getting in the charts for us. And so Peter Powell was perfect, because that was like, you know, kids coming home from school. And we did four tracks for him before we'd even got signed.
But you recorded for Radio 1 there, and that was, and Cut a Long Story Short was actually recorded for that session.
Yeah.
Grab your guitar, show us the riff for that, because that was what hooked the ears of those listeners on the airwaves. It was a riff-driven song, wasn't it?
Now I can't play that riff. That riff is synthesized. Remind me, Tom.
I was going through my Mario Lanza period. Seeing through white light.
But I did write it on the synth, riff. We were going to this club, Billy's, and then Blitz. And this was
everything was happening.
Amazing, this place. I mean, you know, it was like nothing else, was it, Tone?
Well, there was like Kraftwerk, Dusseldorf. There was also, I mean, for me, Ultravox, the Systems of Romance album, still, I think, is one of the best albums ever
with John Fox
as the lead singer.
Right. So you were creating your own scene then? In the image of some of those kind of famous cliques of the past. It was a real art scene and a melting pot of a lot of artistic talents, not just musicians, but fashion designers and filmmakers and writers.
Yeah, I think everyone felt that it was our generation's turn to do something new, and we'd been passed the baton from punk. And this was our moment. And it was, I suppose we all had grown up with seeing Starman on Top of the Pops with Bowie, and that had set the benchmark for how people should look, that there should be theatre in rock.
So you wrote Cut a Long Story Short on the synth. I mean, I presume you would have picked it out on the riff, which is why I said do that. But give us a burst of light, because Tony was itching to get in there on that first verse.
I was trying to remember the words, John. Okay. It's coming to me, girl. Just keep playing. Keep going around that room. That soldier is turning. I see him through white light. Running from stranger. I see you in the valley. Story short, I lost my mind. It finally comes floating back.
See, this is what I love about Master Tapes, because I can put people like you on the spot and ask you to, you know, to draw on the muscle memory after 30 years and see if it still works. And that's amazing that you can
it
do that.
It kind of does.
I mean, when was the last time you did that? That must have been a long
time
ago.
It's a while ago. Well, we did it on the tour when we got back together. Yeah. So it was about 3 years ago.
Never as an acoustic duo, though.
I think that's the first time ever.
The lyrics to those kind of songs, I mean, I suppose they did owe something to Bowie's famous cut-ups, you know, slightly esoteric, this grand landscape that we're all living on. That was the kind of lyric, very early 80s lyric, about a kind of heroic place that we all wanted to put ourselves.
It was lyrically aspirational, wasn't it? It was aspirational stuff.
And that's why when True shifted, really. True was a real shift into personal love songs and storytelling. Cut a Long Story Short is a long way.
Not just three years.
It's a long way from True.
But with True, were you waving goodbye to that, the scene at Blitz and Billy's and that? What was a clique of people in the
know? I think we'd moved on. I mean, times were changing. We were still in connection with a lot of people there and stuff. But you know, all of a sudden, we were kind of pop stars. We were, you know, the Ford Cortina that you got picked up in by the record company was near a limo. And you know, all the people are coming out on the street and going, oh, your boy's done well, hasn't he? And so everything was changing, and all of a sudden, I mean, True was number one in 21 countries around the world, which is fantastic. So for us boys from Islington, it was a dream come true.
Yeah, and you think about the image that you project with the True album, and it is very different, and you're suddenly dressed in the suits, and it is uber aspirational, and it's moneyed, and it looks very glamorous. And Gary, you've written in your book about turning up in the street in Islington where your mum and dad were still living, you and your brother, Martin Kemp, in a couple of Porsches and everybody gathering around. Everything had changed, but we shouldn't forget where you came from. You describe it as the wrong side of the Essex Road in Islington. It was pretty humble, wasn't it?
I think we all have very similar backgrounds in our band. We all met at the local grammar school. My brother and I shared a house. We rented one floor. We had our aunt and uncle renting a floor above us. There was someone else below us and an old lady in the basement, and we all shared one outside loo in the yard, and none of us had a bathroom. And I lived like that till I was 15. So
that luxury.
But my dad went to work every day as a printer in a shirt and tie, you know. I mean, it was...
Yeah. And you went to work as a printer, didn't you, Tony? Because when the band was taking off, you were still holding down the day job.
I was still at IPC, yeah. I was the only one earning any money, so I was the one who's like, right, we need guitar strings, we need bass strings. Right. And you were all selling Miss London or something.
Giving Miss London away outside.
They were very, very different times to today, you know, and it was real community atmosphere, and everyone was really, really proud of us, I think.
And it survived and thrived in the way that it did because you were very much a gang, because there was a gang mentality. That's the way you'd grown up, I guess. And you'd all met at school, you'd all gone to school together at Owens in Islington.
Well, I think we were broader than just the gang of us five. I mean, the whole Blitz crowd, which Tony, one of us went to New York. Yeah. For this trip where we put on a fashion show.
You can imagine the people in New York as, you know, 21 Robin Hoods walking across 42nd Street. It was, there's some fantastic pictures, actually. I mean, it was really bizarre. And I suppose, in a sense, the 80s was the last decade where kids could be different. We've sort of pushed the boundaries of taste and morality to such an extent now that nothing's shockable.
I think we had in our minds that if Cliff Richard and Tommy Steele were the sort of represented British rock and roll, and then The Who and The Small Faces, the mod movement, and then Pink Floyd, psychedelia, Sex Pistols, punk rock, we wanted to be the main band for whatever came next, and it was New Romantics, and that's what it got called in the end. And, you know, we opened the doors in the end for Duran and for Culture Club and all of those bands.
So you saw yourself as the leaders of that scene, and you were the sole songwriter, Gary, within the band. There's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders, therefore. And you were writing songs right in your bedroom as a kid, because you got a guitar when you were, what, 10 or 11 years old?
I got a guitar when I was 11 and a Burt Whedon playing a day, and I thought, this is really boring. If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I thought, hang on, that's really... But I like those chords. So, and I remember playing that to my guitar teacher at school, and he went, well, write some lyrics to it. So I wrote my first song.
Go on.
He said, it's Easter. He said, you better write about Easter. So it was... Jesus rode through Jericho on his way to the cross. He met blind Bartimaeus, who his sight had lost. And then I wrote a song called Alone, and my mum wouldn't let me play it to anyone because she said it was too miserable.
Well, she worried that social services would be around.
And my first band was with Phil Daniels, actually, when I was 11. So it was always something I wanted to do.
Right, right. And so it took off, and you were stars, and then there was a bit of a period of difficulty, wasn't there, with the second album, and things started to go a bit shaky. So it was a conscious attempt to storm the charts.
The thing is, as soon as you get a hit record, all you do is worry about the next one, and then the next one. You never to rest on your laurels is never a good idea. And we had a couple of kind of mishaps on the second album, and it was Instinction that was remixed by Trevor Horn and practically re-recorded, that then put us back in the top 10 again.
Yes. And I said at the beginning of the programme that you emerged from those basement clubs, from that scene at the Blitz, blinking into the spotlight, but also into the sunlight, because you head to the Bahamas to record this album. But it's the sound of a band having fun in the sun as well, isn't it, the True album?
Yeah, it's very much Compass Point, which was Chris Blackwell lived down the road. And I've got to say, I think a big influence on the True album was definitely Steve Norman, because he started picking up the saxophone and getting into percussion as well. And that, I think, had an influence on Gary's writing.
I was a bit of a rocker, and then I became friendly with Steve at school, who was in my class. He started playing guitar, and then I remember going to his house a lot, and he was really into Tamla Motown and Stevie Wonder. Yeah. And I think there was a sense of, we have to move on from here. And we wanted to... I wrote it in the lyric. I bought a ticket to the world. That's what we wanted to do. And I think it was a return to the sort of soul songs that we loved. I was listening a lot of that time to Al Green. I'm going to show you something. And I don't think it's that close, but I'm not certainly not close enough to get sued. But True, I wanted to write an Al Green song.
He tells me.
There he goes. I'm so in love with you. Whatever you want me to is all right by me. Isn't that far away from
I know. Call in the lawyers, come on. Call in the lawyers.
You know, melodically it's far enough away to be original. But, you know, you're sitting at home and they're the music that's in your head, and I think that's the sort of song I want to write. And so then you use it as a springboard to go into your truth, you know.
Right. True, the title track of the album. It's a song about writing a song as well, which I think is really interesting. It's a message, it's almost a letter to a lover who's not returning the affections. And it's based on a true story, isn't it? I mean, it was intended as a love letter.
I'm always quite slightly embarrassed about this. You know, we all look for influences in our life. And I had a slightly unrequited passion for a particular lovely woman, girl. It's the BBC, not that younger girl. And...
I want to hear this as well, because I don't know this either.
And he's obviously not read my book, then.
I haven't even read my own, don't worry about that.
And I actually got a little gift from this girl, and it was the book Lolita by Nabokov.
Right.
And there were some lyrics that I twisted in there that were in there. I mean, people have always said, what are you talking about, Seaside Arms? What's that about? What? Really? What a naff lyric. Well, Seaside Arms is Nabokov. He wrote that about Lolita in the book.
And what did you interpret that as? Is it about having freckled arms?
Sun-kissed arms? Exactly, thank you. And it was about writing it. Why do I find it so hard to write the next line? You know, when I really want to tell you what I'm thinking, but I'm not, I'm being too cryptic. And actually then I thought, I'll put it all in the song.
You've written about this in your book, and you're being unusually coy today. Now, maybe that's because your wife Lauren is sitting here as well. But you have said publicly who you were writing about.
Yeah. I was very friendly with Claire Grogan at the time, and we had this rather coy relationship. You know, as a writer, you're looking for the bigger truth. And Tony's got to sing it, and that's always been with Spandau for me writing. it's never been that personal because this he's is the got man to interpret, who's deliver it.
Tony, I mean, how do you interpret the songs? Do you sit down with Gary, you know, if he hands you a lyric like True, and do you say, what's it about?
Being really honest, some of the songs that Gary's written, I haven't got a clue what they're about. You know, to cut a long story short, you know, standing in the dark, waiting for the man to come, I'm like, oh, God, right, what's this about? But you just put your own stamp on it and your own interpretation. I mean, True is obviously a love song. The Marvin Gaye reference and everything else. So
listening to Marvin all night long.
Exactly. I can't help but sound like Tony Hadley.
Have you always sung like that?
Yeah,
I mean, when you were a kid in the bedroom, was it that whole big projection and the...
Well, my voice kind of changed, to be honest. It was a lot more poppy in the earlier days. And then I got into this sort of Mario Lanza period of... If you listen to some of Bowie's inflections, they're kind of almost semi-operatic. Yes. And I kind of got into that style. And then also listening to really early Sinatra as well. And my mum and dad were massive Sinatra, Ella Fitz, Jack Jones, Tony Bennett fans, and they always said to me, if you want to be a singer, we know you love the Sex Pistols and the Clash and everything else, but listen to these guys. So to this day, I love that style of music.
This was the most attractive thing about Tony,
right?
You know, apart from the fact that he was the only kid at school that had a leather jacket, and we thought that we'd get him in the banks, he's got a leather jacket, you know. But he moved with me as a songwriter into True and the band sound with Steve on sax, and Tony's voice, I think, became more soulful and more black. And Robert Palmer was a big influence on us on that album, I think, wasn't
love
he?
Love Robert Palmer.
And Tony, you do have it. You have a huge voice, and it's very controlled on the True album. And you kind of tap into a sort of more of an emotional tone, I think, on previous albums. And I read Gary writes about it in his book. And if you haven't read it, you won't know that he's already told this story.
I'm so bad at reading books.
Apparently, on a previous session with a previous producer, he couldn't control your voice in the studio and made you sing under a carpet lying down.
Man. This is going to haunt me for the rest of my life. It was the second album, and all of a sudden Richard Burgess says, right, we're going to build a tent in the studio, and then we're going to put candles in it, which is really dangerous. Health and safety wouldn't like it these days. And you sing on your back tone, and we'll get a microphone poised. I'm like, what the bloody hell is going on here? It's madness.
On your back?
I was quite relaxed at the time, I must admit, but I didn't sing anything.
Gary, let me ask you about the track Gold, which is another of the songs that are still played. I mean, you know, the Olympics last year, you couldn't turn on the television without hearing that track, which is great for you. But when you first wrote that, and you'll write it, and it is a song that particularly showcases Tony's voice, did you hear it in your head as a big, dramatic, anthemic track when you first put it together?
Okay, just sort of paint the picture of where I was and how I wrote most of the album. I was still living at home, my mum and dad, with my brother.
Off the Essex Road.
Working class lads don't leave home until they get married. It was just what you did in those days. And you know, even though we'd had six hit singles, I think. So I remember I'd write a song, call my brother in and play it to him. I'll have to play in a different key later for Tony. I wanted to do a James Bond theme song. That was what was in my head. I love John Barry. I love the chords, the sort of, you know, to be here and then... Which is very sort of Eastern European chords. And Gold was obviously, you know, from Goldfinger, I guess, you know, so...
And there's an interesting discord there as well within that. Some of those kind of lines that tumble down in that song.
Yeah. Thank you for coming home. Sorry that the chairs are all worn. I left them here, I could have sworn. I think the brief in the studio was we went more orchestrated on that track. That bum, 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 bum. It was about trying to make a movie thing.
And the image of the band at the time, it developed into smooth, it's sophisticated, it's well-heeled.
I got very irritated, I suppose, in the early 80s by the middle-class writers saying, oh, look at them, they're a bunch of fascists, they're a bunch of Tory... And actually... My point was, and all our point was, you know, working class kids love to spend 100% of their money on their clothes, looking great. For me, that was quite, it was quite political to sort of do that. The suits thing, we got them made at this fantastic tailors in Kentish Town, designed by Chris Sullivan, who was the face from the Blitz and the Billies scene. The idea was we were going to look like American Western gamblers. But in context to what was going on at the time, it was very different.
So you record the album, you know straight away during the playbacks that you're onto something special, do you? I mean, did you know this was going to be the big breakthrough album straight away?
I've got to be really honest with you. When we played it to Chris Wright at Chris's office, so we played the True album, everyone was very excited about it. I didn't think True was a single, but it was Simon Bates, and he played True, and he said, if this is not a number one song, blah, 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 And you know what? I'm going to play it again. Well, that's it.
6.5 minute track.
Yeah.
And it was the last track on the album. I mean, there is a home movie of us shot in Nassau, in the control room, in playback, and everyone's coming, the roadies, the producers, and we're all singing along to this song. And I, you know, I felt it in my water, John, as they say. and as Tony said, Steve's saxophone became another voice within the band. I mean, you know, I would purposely write to elevate his saxophone into its own space. So on True, I know this much is true. And then the saxophone, it changes key. Or whatever the sax does there, but it's got its own, totally own key before returning to the root for the rest of the song. And that just steps it out of the track and puts it somewhere else.
And you say all of the songs were written by you. Would you turn up in the studio with the musicians and say, that's your part, or do you allow them to interpret? How much of the song do you hear in your head
The song is mostly performed on guitar. If the bass riff was really important, that was always, you know, so chart number one or something like that. That was really key to the song. Or on Pleasure. That was the first thing I'd show Martin and say, that is the... Because I wrote it around the riff, because one of the other acts that I absolutely loved was Chic, and the bass guitar had become the lead instrument. I'd learnt a lot about structure as well, I think, and I suppose I was just slotting into more classic structure of verse, bridge, chorus, you know, having a middle eight mostly, and all of the songs on True conform to that structure.
Did it feel, after you returned from the Bahamas and the album took off, it goes to number one, it breaks into the Billboard top 100 charts, in fact top 10 I think in the States, wasn't it? And then the single True is number one for 4 weeks. Did life change very obviously?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when True went to number one, we were in was it Sheffield or Nottingham?
We were in Sheffield on our way to Nottingham.
There you go. Yeah. Champagne being sprayed, we're number one. Yeah, it's like a... It was just the most amazing feeling to have a number one in your own country. Mm. And it was a complete change.
It was a lot harder to get number ones in those days probably than it is now. But the other great thing is, our biggest hero and our biggest influence, we knocked him off of number one.
David Bowie.
Yeah, Let's Dance.
So, did we?
Yeah.
Right.
He's not read David Bowie's book, has he, either? we knocked him off. You know, there was something quite... Yeah. Ironic about that, or fulfilled a dream, certainly.
You rode the waves of fame, the good times were rolling, and you were right at the top of your game, and this until 1990. And then you'd all, I guess, like a lot of bands, spend a lot of time with each other, and it turned sour. You split up in 1990, and then, what was it, 9 years later, you met under very different circumstances in court, and that must have been a terrible time because, you know, Gary, you were being challenged by the other members of the band over the songwriting royalties. Now, you know, I know you don't want to go through all that stuff again.
Thank you, John.
Because...
Just made it up.
It fractured the relationships. It was awful. But, I mean, here, the fact that you're sitting together, it's proof that music can heal.
2009, when we got stepped back into that after a lot of haggling and a lot of... All of us thinking it could never happen again.
Yeah.
And we stepped back into that rehearsal room and the sound immediately was Spandau Ballet.
It's the same as it ever, you know, ever was. It's really... It took a lot of soul-searching, I think, from... Everybody, yourself included and me, we sat in the Flask in Highgate with a couple of pints, with John Keeble as the Henry Kissinger in between us, and over a couple of pints we said, look, can we make this work? Can we bury the past? And that's what we did. And we stood up, I said a few words, you said a few words, and then we shook hands and said, look, let's make this happen.
We both accepted that neither of us were making anything up. We all interpreted the past how we thought it was, and we were truthful about that and honest, but we owed something to the band, to ourselves, to the music,
and having fun as well.
And then suddenly it was a weight off of everyone's shoulders, I think.
Gary, you write very movingly in your memoir about this time, about, you know, thinking you've lost some of your best friends from childhood, and then you lost your mum and dad within days of each other. They both died at the same time. And then, you know, you had a kid within days, and then the band gets together. It's an incredible whirlwind of events. And you write in the book that the death of your parents was one of the things that helped get the band together, because Tony... Gary says in the book that, you know, you were moved by that and you thought, life is too short.
Frank and Eileen, I've known them since I was a kid. As guys in the band, we were incredibly close, but our parents were incredibly close as well. You know, they were so proud of us as kids that had done well. So when that happened, it was like, wow, come on, life's too short. We really have to, you know, rediscover a bit of magic from the past, yeah. which thank God we did.
So this is 2009. You had a great time on tour. There's 2/5 of Spandau Ballet back here today for master tapes. Yes. Will it be all the band back together again sometime soon? What's the state of play?
Well, I think, you know, we're all of a mind that we'd like to get back together again at some point. I mean, we're all busy doing projects. I have an album coming out in October this year and doing some orchestral shows. But we're definitely,
We're putting together a film at the moment, an archive film.
Yeah.
Soul Boys of the Western World, it's called. And it's coming along really well.
I love that title.
Wasn't that an NME headline?
It was an NME headline, yeah, from 1982.
We're going to get 81. Sued by them as well now.
And J.M. Singh might have something to say about it too.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, we would like to do it again at some point. And so we just have to allocate the time and whenever and wherever we'll meet over a pint and put it together.
You see that happening, Gary?
Yeah, I hope so, yeah, because we're a force.
We had a great... I've got to say, the last tour, we did laugh a hell of a lot. I mean, we had great meals out.
You know, sold the most tickets we'd ever sold, which is ironic, you know, because apparently that we were big in the 80s.
Well, that's all we've time for in this first part of the programme. Gary Kemp and Tony Hadley of Spandau Ballet, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Master Tape.
Thank you.
There's a lot more to discuss with Gary and Tony about the Spandau Ballet album True and its legacy in the second part. Our B-side, our studio audience here at Maida Vale will be posing the questions. You can hear that tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 on Radio 4. Of course, this edition will be available to download and listen to via the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can also see videos of some of the exclusive performances from this and previous Master Tape series. And you could tweet about the programme using the hashtag Master Tapes. In the meantime, though, Gary and Tony, you're going to play us out with True.
So true, funny how it seems, always in time, but never land for dreams, head over heels, went toe to toe. This is the sound of my soul. This is the sound. Bought a ticket to the world, but now I've come back again. Why do I find it hard to write the next line? I want the truth to be said. I know
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.